And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
The Athletic.
If I'm being honest, I don't think we actually played that well. Did they have more possession?
Yeah.
They did, yeah.
Yeah?
36% possession for you
36?
Guys.
36?
Yeah. Lowest under the manager's past us, Pep Guardiola, in his time at the club.
God knows that.
Hello and welcome to this week's Athletic Football Tactics podcast. I'm Ali Maxwell, comforted by the presence today of Michael Cox, of Mark Carey, and of Liam Tharm. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
All well?
Yeah, good. All the better for hearing that very cheery greeting from both my colleagues.
Today's topic, I'm really excited about. It came from something we noted in an episode a few weeks back, and we've expanded it now into a full conversation. It's about a phrase that we've all heard many times over the years. Generally, I'd say a pundit talking on TV after a top team has put in a performance that maybe didn't scream dominance, but ended with 3 points. The old cliche, the sign of a good team is winning without playing well. I'm going to ask the guys, is this mythical? Is it a truism? Let's see what comes out in the wash. Michael, come to you first. Winning without playing well, we need to basically nail down the actual phrase. Is it winning without playing well, the sign of a good team? Is it the sign of champions, I think I've heard before as well?
Yeah, I mentioned this in an article once about a year ago. Said, yeah, the old cliche is, you know, the sign of a good team is winning without playing well. And someone in the comments insisted it was actually the sign of champions.
Right.
Does it make a difference? I guess it does. There is a difference between a good team and champions. But I think the sentiment is the same.
And when do people use this phrase? When this is being trotted out, what do people mean by it?
Well, I guess by definition, it has to be a team that you kind of already think are good, right? I mean, when Derby County won one game all season in 2007-08, I doubt after that they went, well, they didn't play well, but they did win. So this is clearly the sign of a good Derby County side. But I mean, I kind of understand the logic for it. It's kind of like they didn't even need to play well. That, you know, they can play in third gear and still get past teams. And I think there's a kind of hint of when they actually play well, they will be spectacular.
So we need to try and work out if there are any inherent characteristics of these teams. Michael, does it to you speak about a certain style of team? Is there a tactical element to this? Is it a psychological thing about team spirit? Where do you think we should start here trying to unpack what defines a team, a good team that wins without playing well?
Well, I think generally champions, the kind of level of champions, it's not really about your ceiling. It doesn't really matter how great you can be. It doesn't matter whether you win games 4-0 or 6-0. What matters is you not having any off days, really. And so I think if you do have a game where you're not playing well and you can grind it out, I think that is a quality to have. And if you are a team who can consistently do that, that's maybe more conducive to winning a title than a side who is on one week and off the next week, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I agree with that. The old cliche of either losses into draws or sort of draws into wins. Particularly, I think I've seen that with sort of promotion chasing teams where they often have to play more games in a season, and that can be an even bigger difference. But I think there's a broader discussion really about what playing well is, quote unquote, and that I think we've got to this very centralised idea in the English game where it's now about sort of having organised possession football, it's about controlling the game with the ball, about pressing high, about playing lots of short, intricate passes, effectively the sort of style that I was told was the Spanish way of playing when sort of I was growing up, and having sort of moved away from that, I think from the academy level now to both domestically across the Premier League, I think that's, you know, most of the teams are trying to do a variant of that. We've spoken about some of the more outlying styles. And I think Spain are now, as a national team, a great example of this because they've, you know, gone out without reaching the final of the last two major tournaments. Luis Enrique had a very specific style of playing it. And ironically, they're the team that many people would say did the opposite of this, of played well and didn't really win what they should have done. They had one shot on target in that game against Morocco from 13 shots, and Morocco had more shots on target than them, despite Spain having 77% possession. And after they lost to Scotland recently, Rodri came out and spoke and was basically speaking down on Scotland's side of play and saying, you know, we're playing this really good way. And this idea now that doing it in an organised possession sense for some teams, the style of the identity is more important than just the result itself. So that for me is fascinating.
To pick up on that, I think there's different versions of playing well, to your point, Liam. And I think that how we define it as not playing well but still winning is how much of a deviation there is from the performance to the outcome as well. So Liverpool's version of playing well stylistically was very different from Manchester City's. But I think that's where the drop-off would be considered to be not playing well if Liverpool were not implementing that the style that they typically would, which was high transition, etc., and far more intensity, whereas Manchester City's version wouldn't necessarily be that. It would be how much or how little they dominate the ball. So I think it's tough because it's relative to the specific team rather than necessarily a general team having played well.
I think Brentford are a perfect example of this. Who have been very good last season, even better this season. Never won a Premier League game with majority share of possession. And they have a very specific sort of defensive style that I think many teams would consider as, this isn't a way that we want to play. But as you say, it's effectively about having a game plan. And I think we've almost got to this point where people have a certain way that they want to see the game played, and they're then evaluating teams based on how they want to watch them play, not what the team are going to say. Okay, this is our style. Obviously, they're not going to openly say we want to play XYZ, but I think we can get a general grasp of, we see teams with different styles in different ways trying to achieve their game plan, and that's really what I think playing well is how well can you achieve your game plan? Because for a certain game, that might not necessarily be winning it, or it might be playing in a certain way, nullifying certain opposition players, maximizing strengths. It's really, you know, dependable on the situation and the circumstances.
I might be taking a slight left turn here, but a phrase that's used more on the continent is that they say that they suffered a lot, and the manager in a post-match interview will say that we had to suffer for long periods, but ultimately we got the result or whatever. I don't know if that is just something which I know that like Xavi would say at Barcelona. I think, Liam, you and I spoke about this, I think, quite common in Spain. Does that kind of also constitute not playing well, but kind of having to go through a bit of a tricky period, weather a storm, but ultimately still come out with a 1-0 win, a 2-1 win, or whatever?
Yeah, I must admit, part of how I feel when I think about this phrase and when we might feel it is partly to do with possession. When a team that's, let's say, a title contender is playing against a team in the bottom half of the Premier League, Liam sort of alluded to it, there's a certain way that we think these games play out. There's a certain dominance with the ball that we expect the favourite to have. So in my head, this scenario often comes around when we don't see that. And it's a little jarring. Well, that team, they really didn't dominate the ball nearly as much as we thought. So it comes back, Michael, to things not looking the way that maybe it's expected to look, but being able to handle those situations. And that strikes me as something psychological almost. Okay, we're under the cosh here. It's not going the way that we planned. It's probably not going the way that we've trained for and planned for all week. But we're still going to find a way here. We're still going to do what we need to do in this situation.
Yeah, I think you're right about it being something that isn't planned. So you wouldn't say it for like Mourinho's first Chelsea team, right, for example, because they were a counter-attacking side. They were accustomed to playing without the ball. That was their game plan.
Do you think everyone knew that at the time, though? Or was that unusual at its time, that the way that they played? Do you think the punditry around the time was, well, we know this is how they play, so don't worry too much if it doesn't look very title-winning?
I think it probably was, yeah. I mean, there were a few different phases of that Chelsea team, I think. At times, they're a bit more entertaining.
I think that people need to realise that that is just ways of winning different types of games and what win you titles, that there's going to be games where you're going to need to defend deeper at times. Napoli are a fantastic case study for this. When you look at perhaps their style tweaks between the Champions League, where they've not been as ball dominant compared to in Serie A, where they've been one of the most expansive teams in the league. But I think Kim Min-jae, their primary centre-back, he's in the top 5 or 6 for clearances, which, you know, you'd be absolutely amazed if you ever saw a Manchester City centre-back in the top 10 of the Premier League for clearances. But I think now, being adaptable and being able to adjust, especially as there's more subs now, I know across wider competitions, because obviously a lot of these top teams are playing not just league football, but also trying to challenge in cups and in European competition, that you need that adaptability in order to go through those periods and to suffer in those games. And I think the interesting point about the use of the terminology, not to go too in depth to it, is it doesn't seem to be a problem in how they convey it. They're sort of saying, that's okay, that's part of what we had to do, is suffering. Like, it's not dangerous, it's not necessarily problematic. We don't, as we've said, we don't set out to achieve that, but we accept that that's going to happen in times, and we just need to get through that and deal with it and then recover.
I think the biggest or the best example of that at the team level, more probably in knockout football in the past 12 months or so, has been Real Madrid. And I know that Michael did a piece off the back of El Clasico yesterday. I watched that game, and for the first half, I mean, they're already 1-0 down in the Copa del Rey against Barcelona on aggregate. The first half, Barcelona, I think, had 59% of the possession. They were dominating the game. And Real Madrid, they were just so adept at knowing, okay, we are, quote-unquote, suffering here. We're going to, you know, have our backs against the wall a little bit. And they scored at the end of the first half and went on to win the game 4-0. And they were just a perfect example of, they don't need to dominate the whole game. They dominated in spells. They certainly came into it more in the second half, when obviously the scoreline had changed and the whole the game style had changed at that point. But you think about last season, the Champions League as well, they were, what was it, in the 89th minute, I think they were 1-0 down on aggregate, or, you know, they were one goal behind on aggregate against Manchester City, scored three goals in about 10 minutes. What was the other one? PSG, they were down, they scored a, I think Karim Benzema scored a 17-minute hat-trick. Liverpool in the final, Liverpool arguably, but I think Liverpool did dominate that game. Real Madrid win 1-0. So they are just, I think, in recent history and in general, the perfect example of teams who are happy, comfortable to suffer. They have the experience in the squad to know that they've got moments players.
I've got two things off the back of that. The first one is just, I think France are a great international version of sort of Real in that regard, that they often don't control periods of games, often sit off defensively. We've spoken obviously about Mbappe and a general sort of team idea where they don't do a lot of intense defending, which is maybe also a theme of international football. But you look at the fact they've reached a Nations League final, the last two World Cup finals, you know, they've reached a Euros final under Deschamps as well. Without necessarily always going through and being the best team. I know Coxie's written before about, you know, we often overestimate the quality that's needed to win trophies and knockout football. And I guess my question to you guys at the back of that would be, do we almost need to start viewing it and analysing it differently to how we look at league football? And I think about the comparisons to maybe different formats of cricket in that regard, where you have to play them in different ways, because you're almost not playing in a way that's designed to be sustainable. You need to win or not lose games in knockout football. You don't necessarily need to put in performances that you can go and do every week and repeat them. And when, like, as you say, aggregate scores come in, things get different, because if you're leading from the first leg, you might, you know, be more passive, etc. But it's a very specific way that probably doesn't translate into league football, and I just wonder what you think off the back of that.
Yeah, I think it's something we've spoken about before, isn't it, with Pep Guardiola, of how he likes to exert dominance in terms of possession, and that works really well in the league, because more often than not, you will be the dominant team who comes out on top. I think that was maybe a little bit of his downfall in cup competitions, certainly in the Champions League, where you come up against a transitional side and you can get picked apart, and then, as you say, it's a one-off game and that's you out of the competition. So I certainly say that would definitely ring true. I think that was why Liverpool had a lot of success historically under Jurgen Klopp, in terms of their ability in transition to just be all action, and it would blow the team away in a one-off game, certainly in the knockouts, and that's why they've had a lot of success in knockouts, but not necessarily always consistently in the league. So I'd say that tallies, passes the eye test.
Strikes me that possibly the most difficult part of this conversation is, we hypothetically take a team that has won a couple of games in the last few in which this phrase would apply. You know, they suffered, they weren't at their best, but they won. There's now a lot more that we look at in terms of performance analysis over time that is used to be predictive. So halfway through a season, you may be able to look at performance levels and underlying numbers, and you may think that that will be more predictive for the second half of the season than just the pure results, the points tally that they have at that point. So the question is, for a hypothetical team that's in this scenario, working out whether it's fair to say, well, maybe they've just got it, they've got this sign of a good team that can suffer, get through it and win games, or actually, I'm a bit concerned about this team in the long term, because I'm not sure they're actually playing very well.
Yeah, I mean, to sort of flip it on its head, I think we've spoken about this before in terms of overperformance against expected goals. And you could look at it as from one of two ways. You could say that eventually, yeah, that they will regress to the mean and eventually it will catch up with them. Or
I thought that was going to be a bigger part of the conversation so far, I'll be honest. Because it strikes me that a part of this is, like, I suspect that many of its uses in history have been pundits in a situation where they are reacting to an outcome, a win. They can't say the performance was great because they know it wasn't great. So they're trying to almost justify or retrofit a narrative based on the outcome more than anything else.
Yeah, I do think it's narrative based, certainly. I think that at the season level, rare occasions, but you can still have it at the season level where a team does overperform and their performances suggest that they shouldn't necessarily be winning certain games. But a season in the grand scheme of things from a data perspective is still quite a small sample to go from. And if you can overperform, I think, Liam, you might have mentioned this a few weeks ago, if you can overperform, it's also a sign of a team who is resilient, who is able to do these things. And it's not we shouldn't use it as a stick to beat teams with. We should use it as a positive to say, they're breaking the models, quote unquote, the statistical models. And in the short space of time of a season, if you can do that, then you are still deserved winners.
An athlete in athletics will have a season's best and sort of a personal best. And these unsustainable levels of performance that they're trying to reach when it comes to major competitions, to an Olympics in particular, this is what teams want when they get through the latter stages of, you know, we're now coming into the Champions League quarterfinals, that you don't want to be trying to reach a level of performance that you can do for 30 games in a season. You want this to be your best three or four games of a season, which means if you don't create many chances, fine, that's not necessarily a problem because you don't necessarily need to, as long as you keep things tight defensively. But it's where, and I really like expected goals as a metric before anyone thinks I think otherwise, I'm all for it, but it's not designed to be used in that such a small, in such a small manner. And I've seen in the Bundesliga coverage that after a goal is scored, they'll put up the goal probability, which I just assume is XG put into a percentage format. And it's not the point of the statistic. And I think it then gets really reductionist and overlooks for what are me the two most important skills in football, which are being able to score a goal and the technique that's required within that. And players sort of get branded as lucky, which they're not. They're elite athletes. Someone like Son Heung-min, who is frequently, I know he hasn't this season, but has frequently overperformed his expected goals, is because he trained both of his feet for 10-15 years with his father. And the same on the flip side for shot stopping, that we spoke about the Champions League final. Thibaut Courtois made a record 9 saves. I think that should be celebrated. I think reducing it to a game of just chance creation doesn't work necessarily as your pure sort of overall analysis, in that there is value and a successful team needs to, because they will, everyone will have games where you don't make many chances, but then winning both the boxes when you don't win the bit in the middle, that's also a way to win a game of football. And I think that's why many coaches now are like, yeah, okay, fine, we have to do that sometimes.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
One of the early strengths of expected goals was to try and avoid pure outcome bias when it comes to just looking at results and the scorelines. But it's almost brought in another outcome bias of its own now, where there's sometimes just looking at the XG instead of the scoreline can cause problems on that front.
Yeah, I do think saying, you know, we won the XG, to Liam's point, on a single game basis is quite risky. I think it is a very noisy stat across a single game. It can be, you know, just like any statistic, it can be a useful tool to inform your opinion, but don't use it kind of as a crutch to base your conclusions from. I think from like a data perspective to maybe analyze the game, if we are going to use it on a single game basis for expected goals, I'd probably say that there's two versions of everything we've spoken about, quote unquote, winning without playing well, which can influence things from a data viewpoint. I'd say that there's either the smash and grab win, where the opposition dominates, whether that is in possession, in shots, in XG, but they just simply can't convert. They're missing all their chances. I think it happened with Chelsea and Liverpool earlier this week. Can't convert. And then your team has a fairly average value chance, and then they convert that opportunity. You might lose the XG battle in that regard, but you come out with the win because you've just converted your single chance. Smash and grab win. I think the second one is kind of grinding it out win, which I think you allude to before, Ali, which is can look very different by the numbers in terms of still having a quote unquote winning without playing well. But in this case, your team might dominate possession. It might be up against a minnow of a team. It might be up against a low block, forced into a lot of low value chances, shooting from distance, failing to break down that block and get in behind. So you could still think, okay, well, we're not playing well here. We're not able to break them down. But you might still then convert a chance from a corner or from a scrappy goal and still win that way. The XG looks very different there. Both are kind of under the umbrella of a winning without playing well, but it can look ultimately very, very different from a data perspective as well.
Yeah, I think in my head, this probably applies better in the latter scenario, not the scenario where you've basically been under the cosh, you've been getting battered all game, which frankly doesn't happen very often for the sorts of teams that would be, you know, given this this sort of praise or this line. It is that other one. It's we felt a bit off it and we struggled with what we came up against, but we just about got it right. Mm.
Gonna prove Mark right here, because it was a great example from the Manchester United Brentford game last night, where Brentford defended in a pretty deep 5-3-2, kept trying to deny United all the space. They kept being forced down the sides, and they were playing with sort of Rashford at number nine, who wasn't really being fixed. He was roaming a lot, and they got an awful lot of corners. They scored the only goal from the game off the second phase of a corner. But it was interesting to see sort of post-match, when you look at the stats, that Brentford had one chance, a one-on-one against De Gea, which they missed. United scored their one big chance of the second phase of that corner. So they had 65% possession, had 18 shots to Brentford 6, but 10 of their shots came from outside the box, 8 were inside, and the XG wasn't sort of a million miles in terms of a difference. So you look at that and go, oh, you've had all the ball and not really broken them down at all. But Ten Hag was quite positive. He described them as a very tough opponent when you see the results against top teams. It's very difficult to create chances against them, and we created something. I think we almost overestimate what a good performance is sometimes. Managers, and I guess why that would annoy people, because you go, oh, if I expected an 8-9 out of 10 and they're satisfied with a 7, that's just going to be a discrepancy. But that to me is, yeah, again, fascinating.
And that's where I think it relates to what I said before in terms of that deviation from the manager's perspective of where you are or where you've been versus where the manager wants them to be. But I think kind of going a little bit deeper beyond XG alone, that's kind of why I like the match momentum charts after a game. You see them often on the Opta Analyst. I know that John Muller of our parish has created a visual that's very similar, where basically what this does is look at each team's maximum probability during every 3-minute period in a match and the difference between the teams scoring chances within that period. So essentially, the more bars that you have within the chart across the 90-minute period, the more dominant you have been within the game in both boxes. So I think it's always a nice way of just showing graphically and visually when there's been kind of more domination, rather than just saying that, yeah, we won the XG battle.
In particular with an example where a team maybe scored a penalty or scored a tap-in. And that can actually overpower almost everything else that happened in the game if you just look at the expected goals number after 90 minutes. But in that sense, those momentum graphs, of course, that would be reflected in that portion of the game, but you may be able to get a larger overview of the quieter parts of the game, shall we say.
The concept of momentum in football is something I find fascinating, because I had a lecture on this last year whilst I was still studying, and we sort of compared it to basketball, which I know Ali will know about, but the way they often sort of measure momentum there can be done directly through scoring points, because scoring happens simply more frequently. It's really strange in football, I think, because often once teams score, they will then not be as attacking. I think for the first, or so let's say 5-10 minutes afterwards, teams tend to, unless they're genuinely chasing a game, but for the most part, you work to score and you sort of sit back a bit more, you're a bit more conservative, you know, you defend what you've got, sort of thing. But that almost then, within the momentum part of it, needs you to keep attacking but not actually score, so to keep getting in the shooting positions or keep getting into a position box but not get the goal that you want. And it's almost counterproductive that to keep having momentum, you need to not get the thing that momentum is trying to achieve, because you then score. And for most teams, you're going to go, fine, right, we've got the goal now, we can sit back, or, you know, we don't need to rush and panic as much. It's I think it's a really valuable way to try and measure, as you say, Mark, a part of the game that looks at the flows and the changes. But I think it's just, it's almost inherently really difficult to look at and measure again, because football is just such a low scoring sport that the thing that you want then is going to happen so infrequently that you're looking at everything else, but everything else ties back into the goal. And then it's like, well, now what do we look at, sort of thing?
Underlying numbers, that's what you want.
Michael, are there any teams, either current or I'd like to hear about some maybe from past decades, that to you most encompass this phrase when you hear winning without playing well, the sign of a good team? Who do you think had that said most about them?
I think of Ferguson's Manchester United, and maybe I think of that because I've seen them win a title more than I've seen any other team win a title. But they did have a real ability to grind it out and get wins in quite unglamorous fashion. And I think in general, when it was Ferguson's Manchester United against Wenger's Arsenal would play like the best football. Like, their ceiling would be the highest. They play some incredible stuff, but they'd also have massive off days. And I think Manchester United, when they weren't playing well, they could still win. And so I think that phrase, certainly in relation to that team, probably made sense.
I think that was probably what I was expecting. Any more recent, Liam, that spring to mind for you?
The Lionesses, the England women's team, were fantastic at the Euros. And I won't go into depth because you guys have covered that in many pods and many pieces. So for people that want... and quite fortunately, I think you guys had a lot of episodes during the tournament, during the stages. So I'd encourage, go back, because there's 4 or 5 hours there where you can listen to, I think, every podcast you were saying, Serena Riegman's going to change the squad. You know, kept the same starting 11 the whole way through. He's like, definitely this time. But yeah, having their sort of same core side and same key subs and not starting games fantastically and then blowing multiple teams out the water. I think they're a great example internationally and domestically, or in sort of European competition. I thought Eintracht Frankfurt were fantastic in their Europa League run. Quite a good sort of organised 5-4-1 mid-block. Very, very good crossing side. Very good counter-attacking side. They had more games where they had a minority share of possession than they had the majority share, conceded just once in 11 of their 13 games. So I think just being so solid defensively, and that then sort of transpired into the final and how they won that, which they then went and won on penalties, and had a goalkeeper that was the best in the tournament for post-shot XG and additional goals prevented. So all the elements I think that you want in a tournament winning team.
I feel like the aspect of this that applies to knockout tournaments and competition football is quite different to what we're talking about in terms of league football.
So where does the Champions League come into that? In the sense that that's club football, but it's also knockout football.
Yeah, I don't think it's hugely applies to the conversation. Like, it strikes me that this has probably almost never been said about Manchester City in the last few years, because when they are, let's say, under their average performance level, they're probably still exerting a level of possession and, dare I say it, shot-based dominance on the opposition.
Yeah, I think with the Manchester United example, it's because they were so good at coming from behind, or, as Liam said before, turning draws into wins. Whereas Manchester City, again, off the top of my head, it feels like they are always the ones to score first. And at very worst, they'll be drawing. There's not too many occasions where they go behind. Of course, they do lose the odd game, but if ever they do go behind, it's early on, and it's almost like a, how dare you do that? Now you've awoken the beast, and then they'll probably just go 2 goals up in the first half or something. But I think in every league campaign, there's never going to be a situation where a team blows the opposition out of the water in every game. So, you know, off the top of my head, you've got the Vincent Kompany goal for Manchester City against Leicester, where he put it top bins when he could have easily drawn that game. I think was it the 17-18 season that Sterling scored that curler in like the last minute against Southampton? There's occasions throughout each season, each title-winning season, where the team is about to draw, is about to drop points, and they go and kind of score a goal that maybe they didn't deserve to, or could have easily not scored a low-value chance. So
I'm getting a new episode idea forming about the concept of, and I think Coxie's going to hate the use of this word, the concept of clutch plays.
Yes.
And how much we can, you know, how random they are or otherwise in football. And we know that they're quite important.
It's interesting, Ali, that you said that about City and not tending to do the thing of winning when not playing well. Because I think Arsenal was the one example in recent memory where they have done that, where they didn't have a lot of possession. There's that great clip post-match where Jack Grealish is surprised to hear the amount of possession that they've had. And the goals that they scored, the first one is off, you know, a real big defensive error. It's a great finish, but comes about for defensive error. There's a high turnover, I think, for the second one. So maybe if that's a part of their game, they can start to really add in, because they've not been necessarily at their best this season. I remember going back through Mark's piece from August where he looked at basically sort of seeing after Liverpool's bad start if their title run was already over, and I think it was that the title winning team has never lost more than six games in a season since 2000. So as we were saying about, I think teams can often overlook the value of draws at times. Brentford and Newcastle are both right up in the league this season because they've drawn a lot. They're not quite up at the top, but Newcastle are looking at Champions League for the first time in a long time. Brentford obviously pushing for Europe for the first time. So I think even sort of slightly off from purely just the title winning teams, that can also have big repercussions for teams that are chasing real good top half finishers.
I think I felt coming into this that there might be a desire to be sort of myth busting here. I think I felt, probably because I feel like you used to hear this a lot in previous decades, that this might be a bit of old, you know, a bit of an old school cliche, sort of, as I've suggested, maybe kind of retrofitting a narrative to a match's outcome. But it strikes me, Michael, actually having discussed it, that we broadly as a collective think there is validity to the phrase. There's substance to it.
Yeah, I think it kind of goes back to the debate about what the phrase is, about whether it's a sign of a good team or the sign of champions. So, for example, a good example I can think of a game where a side played badly and won was Arsenal at Leeds earlier this year in about October on a Sunday. I remember because I was there and there was a floodlight failure or a power cut and it got delayed by about an hour. And Arsenal were terrible that day. Like, they didn't create anything. Saka scored a goal out of nothing. Leeds missed a penalty. They missed a few chances. They thought they had a penalty in the last minute that then got overturned. Like, Arsenal were really bad, probably the worst I've seen them play this year. I don't think you can look at them winning that and think that's the sign of a good side, because they weren't a good side. But can you say it's the sign of champions? We kind of can, because they've got 3 points they didn't really deserve. And I don't think there's a, you know, this whole things even themselves out over the course of the season. I mean, we know they might not. I think it's just a truism. I think basically the point we're making is they've done well to get 3 points from that. On another day, they might have got 0 points. And therefore, they're going to be 3 points higher up the table than they might have been. I almost think it might be as simple as that when you think about it.
Okay. Well, I guess to finish then, the really difficult question that I want to ask you guys is, can we try and think about these sorts of teams and isolate some similar characteristics or some parts of these teams that we think makes them more likely to win games when not at their best versus a team that doesn't win those games? Because Lord knows lots of teams don't win those games and don't end up as champions. So it could be anything in the tactics, anything in the makeup of the squad or the type of manager to support this idea, Liam, that it's more by design than just pure luck and outcome.
Yeah, I was intrigued when I did the research as to Arsenal have had the most goals slash assists by substitutes in the league this season, which is 14 altogether. And of course, my own Coxie was there recently when Reece Nelson scored the winner against Bournemouth. And I think having that depth now is even more, one, important, and two, just probably necessary by this point, because you're going to be able to change five players in the game. And I guess that will then require a different type of tactician as a manager to be reactive and maybe a bit more perceptive and maybe be more flexible and be prepared to be sort of open-minded, yeah, and adapt to the games, because there'll probably be a period, effectively, I think, if most teams, I'm going to generalise and make subs around the 60th minute, you've kind of got an hour of a match, then maybe a 15, 20 minute period where things are in a massive state of flux, because you could have half of the outfielders that are possibly sort of changing over, and then sort of a final end game. On that, Arsenal have scored the joint most, conceded the joint fewest goals in the last 15 minutes of game. So I think just impacting games late, and of course that's interesting because the big notion around then this season has been they started games really quickly, started both halves often with early goals. But I think that is quite literally how you turn draws into wins and losses into draws, because you're going to impact games when teams haven't got a chance to respond against you because there's just no time left.
I think to answer your question as well, Ali, it might be a little bit reductionist in the answer, but just having really, really good finishes is going to be key in terms of that. Well, I mean, you spoke about that clutch before, right? Someone who is that good that irrespective of whether it, you know, you've not been playing well and it's the 89th minute and this is your first opportunity of the game, you need someone who's going to be ice cold in that situation. You need a Lionel Messi, you need a Ronaldo. You think of you know, we spoke about Manchester United, Ruud van Nistelrooy be someone who is just going to score something out of nothing. His job was just pretty much to score.
Like Andy Kirk at Bradford City at the moment.
Exactly.
It's probably the other obvious.
Yeah, I was about to say Kylian Mbappe, but you beat me to the elite forward there. But, you know, yeah, an Mbappe, a Benzema, those sorts of players who are currently playing who are just absolutely elite finishers and just need kind of one opportunity. Again, that happened in El Clasico yesterday. Just first proper counter-attacking move, Vinicius Jr. to Karim Benzema, goal.
I think you probably need good aerial players a lot of the time as well, because you're going to be defending often a lot of crosses if you're under pressure, and also set pieces. I think set pieces are just such a big part of football, and they're almost outside the game in terms of the tactics, in terms of the strategies. It's almost like a game within a game. So if you can just be dominant in both boxes aerially, I think you've got a good chance of winning without playing well.
And surely if we talk about elite finishers, then elite shot stoppers have to be a big part of this conversation for riding out those tough moments.
Yeah, definitely. Courtois in a Champions League final, I think you mentioned earlier, Liam, was a good example. I think as well, just to finish, it's worth asking what happens if we reverse the phrase. Like, if a side plays well but doesn't win, what is that a sign of? I mean, the XG kind of argument would suggest that is the sign of a good side.
Brighton being probably the example of that in recent seasons.
Straight away, what sprung to mind was probably a comfortable possession-based team that probably have more of the ball and potentially have a higher volume of shots, but who, for whatever reason, are not winning the battle in both boxes.
I think it's amazing, and I probably disagree with the idea that I think those teams get celebrated more than the teams that win when necessarily play badly. So not many people seem to like Real Madrid. Brighton under Potter got an awful lot of support and I think praise for fair parts of doing well in games, but I just don't see how you can't enjoy teams that are winning games of football however they choose to go about winning it. Like, that's their prerogative.
Understanding that this is just building a prototype, broad brushstrokes, we're probably looking at a team who tactically are not obsessed with a heavy possession-based style. So some of the teams that we've talked about, Real Madrid, Manchester United under Sir Alex Ferguson, you know, teams who are happy soaking up pressure, fairly comfortable having periods without the ball, and very dangerous and happy in moments of transition. Psychologically, I'm not sure if you can ever really nail this down, because who are we to really judge the psychological strength of players? But broadly, of course, we're talking about a team that as a collective have a certain appetite for difficult periods, for suffering, to use the phrase that they use a lot in Spanish football. A team that has excellent finishers inside the opposition penalty box and ideally very good shot-stopping goalkeepers as well. A team ideally that can finish strongly, maybe in games where the initial game plan, plan A, hasn't worked that well and the game's still tied after 70 minutes as a result. But good off-the-bench options, good substitutions from the manager just to make the last 20 minutes a little bit easier or to mix things up if necessary. Arsenal this season have done that very well. And it cannot hurt to be a strong set-piece team. Big old positive set-piece goal difference for, again, those situations where open play, the dominance hasn't quite been realised. And this is why I really enjoy having these conversations. I think it's a difficult one to have. I think that there's a lot to discuss, and I really enjoy your thoughts on the matter. So thank you to Michael, to Mark, and to Liam. Winning without playing well, the sign of champions, the sign of a good team. It'd be great to hear your thoughts as well. You can get in touch with us on Twitter, of course, but also you can be part of the community on the Athletic app. The podcast has its own page, and each episode has its own comments section. I'd love to see that filled with some thoughts on this. I'm sure there's plenty of stuff that we haven't touched on, haven't expanded on, maybe some things that we said that you weren't so sure about or particularly agreed with. So do get in touch. I think these are the sorts of conversations that we love having. So in that sense, we do want to hear from you as well. So please do get in touch. Make sure you subscribe to this podcast feed and subscribe to The Athletic today as well. It's crunch time, isn't it? The last 6 weeks or so of the European season. So much good stuff on The Athletic site. TheAthletic.com/tactics is the place to go to sign up. If you don't have a subscription currently, you'll pay £1 a month for the first year of your subscription, theathletic.com/tactics. Good stuff. Thank you very much. And please do join us again next week on the Athletic Football Tactics podcast.
The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.